Welcome to a Leader's Journey podcast. I'm your host, Joel Gunn. Today I have with me Daniel Grove. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, so glad to be here.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to getting you on the air with me for a while now. For those that don't know, Daniel is a master creative extraordinaire expert. He rules that universe well. We know that's true in my family, because if you've followed my family on Facebook very long, you know that we do interesting Christmas cards, themed Christmas cards, and Daniel is the man that makes the magic happen. If you saw the photo shoots, you wouldn't be that impressed, but once Daniel's done with it, we get compliments all the time about our Hollywood style photos. So that's all thanks to you, Daniel.
My pleasure.
How'd you end up in the creative field? Have you known since you were a kid that was an interest? Or
yeah, my whole family is very creative. I have two older brothers, and we're all drawing artists, all nerds. My mom is a designer type of artist. My dad is kind of the three-dimensional type designer artist. So it's just in our genes, and we can't get away from it. So I've always been a creative artist in various like media, you know, Legos, drawing, 3D graphics, video editing, and discovered photography in high school. So it's always been in there somehow, and just find different ways to express it.
Did you have any particular mentors, you know, as you've grown up, either in the creative world, or you're also active in your church and have been as mm-hmm. long as I've known you? You're also active in business. So any mentors along the way?
I didn't have as many as I wish I should have had, that I know I should have had. I had very few early on, and I wasted a lot of years learning stuff the hard way. You never forget those lessons, but at the same time, you waste a lot of time. So I calculated at one point, it took me about 8 years to get good at photography, like to get my portraits where I knew what was going to happen when I pressed the button, and I knew how to improve that. And that's because I didn't have anyone helping me. I did have someone take a risk on me early on, and they let me borrow their professional equipment to do a wedding. I already had my own stuff, but he had like way better stuff. And he let me use all his stuff for one wedding, and that was incredible. And then years later, unfortunately, I met an awesome guy here in San Antonio named Jim Landers. He is the hero of the photography community. I'm sure you even know him. Probably even met him.
Yes, I do.
He's such a great guy, inside and out. And he helps the photography community with business strategies and education. He also teaches the art and the technical stuff, but he's known for his business, everything business. And he helps photographers get sustainable and profitable, and basically kicks their butt into gear into making the money they should be making. And he changed my life big time. And some of his students also helped me get to that point. So, yeah. He's been a big influence in other photographers.
I don't know Jim personally, but if you're anywhere even in the periphery of photography in San Antonio, you've heard the name.
Yeah,
the man, everybody the that I knows him. Yes, for sure. Everybody that knows him respects him and appreciates him.
Yeah.
So, and I've seen him compliment your work.
Yeah, that's an honor.
You know, online. So yeah, it's huge. Thinking about mentors for a minute, you said you wish you'd had more. How does that translate for, you know, people that are in leadership today? How do we go out and find mentees, or have you given that any thought?
Man, leaders of all kinds need mentors. It's kind of extreme maybe, but Christian cults happen because people don't have appropriate mentorship. They go way good off point. Left field, get into crazy stuff because they didn't have anyone to go, psh, what's the matter with you? No, that's not what this means. Like, you know, we need people above us to keep us in line, and they need people above them to keep them in line. And eventually the top, you know, apostles, whatever, business leaders, they keep each other in line and encourage each other and are friends with each other, because that's what you need sometimes. It's just a normal friend. So yeah, leaders really need mentors at different levels to teach them, to show them what's going on, and to kind of help them not get burned out and not give up.
It's been my experience that I've had two types of mentors in my life, and actually had the pleasure of interviewing maybe two of them so far on the podcast. One of them was the type where I got very little interaction with him, but he made sure I was in the right place at the right time, and cleared a path for me. And really, and even though it seems like a small contribution, because of some of making sure I was in the right place at the right time had a huge impact on my career and my life overall. Cool. And then there's the mentors you get to spend a lot of time with.
Yeah.
And I think the world's really hungry for those types of mentors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But finding them, there's no equation that I know of to find mm-hmm. that perfect mentor. You know, God brings them into your life. Wise choices help you find them. Being in the right community as already will help you find, you know, people that are in line with your goals and your visions. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also bad mentors for you. you have to be careful. They may have a totally different worldview. They may have a very mm-hmm. different business understanding of what business is. And, you know, they may not be leading you down the path that you need to be following. So you have to choose wisely who you let influence you. And look at their fruit, look at their life, you know, have a relationship with them and don't just jump in. They should have something to prove their value as an authority in your life.
Yeah. And I think that goes with any relationship really is, you know, kind of slow go is often the best. It's changing subject on you a little bit. There's risk involved in looking for a mentor. There's risk involved in being in business. How have you mitigated risk? I'm sure, especially in the creative world, and we'll get into some other aspects of that. But what's some of the risk you faced, or how did you navigate those? Any advice for that?
Yeah, there's a lot of risk being self-employed in an art career. Just those two things together is like insult to injury, or I don't know if that's the right metaphor, but when you combine those two things, it's dangerous. And so there's a lot of risk. You're relying on people to value something that's abstract and subjective to provide for your livelihood. And I have five kids. It's like, ooh, am I going to pay rent this month? I got to hustle and I got to network and do all the things I got to do. So yeah, there's an amount of risk every week for me. But like some of the big risks I've taken, some of them I've been in. One was an investment in buying a second camera. I already had a nice camera that I bought in 2019. And then I bought another of the same one, I think 2 years later, because I realized I was growing and I needed a second identical camera for video production reasons, multi-camera type productions. And it was scary because that camera was $2,500, just the camera. And then I had to buy, you know, a few other accessories for it. So that was one like financial risk. Business risks for me was
$2,500 buys a lot of shoes for kids.
Yeah. And meals. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much groceries.
And food.
Yeah. Not as much as you think, but it's relatively a lot. Yeah. That's like 5 weeks of groceries for me. Just nice. About. I changed my business model because of Jim Landers. He helped me see a bigger picture of what I could do with my time and my skill. Mm-hmm. You know, God gives us talents, literal, and he gives us talents monetarily, and he gives us time to use. And so we have those time, talent, and treasure that we need to invest wisely. We could also waste them and squander them too. And so my talent as a photographer is pretty unique. You know, I try not to be prideful. I never put other photographers down, but there's not a lot of photographers like me that do what I do in Texas or.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
Central Texas, I'll say, because I know the Central Texas community pretty well. And so I'm like, I have something unique and I want to like make the most out of it. And I want to work it, invest it to provide for my family. Mm-hmm. So he helped me with business model and pricing strategies and sales techniques, which I had none of. It's a lot of psychology. It's a lot of self-esteem and self-worth situations. Battle of the mind. Wasn't there a book about years ago?
There is.
It is a battle of the mind. Selling yourself, basically. You know, selling your time and your skills. So that was scary. And it was like this hill that took me like a year and a half to get over. And a friend of mine, Brandy Morgan, who was a student of Jim Landers, she was like an outside. You know how you can talk to your sibling different than you can talk to your parent? Mm-hmm. It's really weird. It's sort of like that, very vaguely, I guess. Brandy was a driving factor that helped me see that this business model is not just Jim Landers' thing that he teaches. It's a thing that works for her, for Brandy, and many other photographers. So yeah, I was like, okay, she's a confirming factor that Jim Landers stuff works, right? That's kind of full circle. Sorry, this dog is going crazy for Oh my gosh, it's got the zoomies. And yeah, so that's how that happened.
Yes. You know, you talked about taking risks, changing your business model, really diversifying in some ways, and maybe you can unpack that in here in a minute. But there's always, as you do those things, there's always risk for, you know, mental health crisis, burnout.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Those kinds of things. How do you, what's your personal routines or secrets or thoughts on avoiding that kind of stuff or feeding yourself?
It's really important that you don't get stuck in the various ruts that will lead you into burnout, because there's a lot of them and you don't know what they are until you get there and it's not pretty. It's sort of weird for me, because, and I feel like this might almost be borderline unhealthy, but because I love my work so much, it almost is the refreshing thing for me, probably because my work involves so much variety. You know, I don't just do one category. I do pretty much everything, but, how do I word this appropriately? adult related photography, portraits. I don't do that. I don't do boudoir or anything suggestive. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, but other than that, I do pretty much everything. Headshots, product photography, weddings. I do video as well. I'm diversified in that world. So the variety of my work itself keeps me from burnout for the most part. Mm-hmm. I do have some non-photography things that are still creative and fun for me. I do 3D design. I use an incredible free program called Blender, and it is just awesome. It's free, but it can do almost Hollywood level stuff. So just playing in Blender and learning that, and that is, that's actually a side hustle of mine is Blender assets and tutorials. So that's mm-hmm. another of my jobs, but it's so fun and it's refreshing and it's different than photography. So, I enjoy that on the side. Sometimes I'll have a really stressful, busy week or month of photography stuff, and I will like stop one night or a few nights a month, and I will just do Blender for hours. And that like gets that on my system. And it's like, okay, you know, it was fun. Made some cool stuff. Let's get back to editing photos or video. So yeah, for me, and I'm a creative. So I have creative hobbies like Blender and some other things that, you know, do that for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. What about, you know, some people play music or they'll, you know, go for a hike up the side of the mountain.
Yeah.
Any of those kinds of things, or you find all your energy just being in creative?
Yeah. It's pretty much all in creative stuff. I don't have a lot of time or luxury to go and do walks and hikes and trips and vacations, because I have five kids and doing those things with them is not necessarily recharging. I love them, yeah, but it's a production.
Takes going, some energy, sure.
Going to the store. And then one other place after that, you got to plan all this stuff. So yeah, that would be great. I would like to do that, but I haven't.
Well, those days will come.
Yeah.
You triggered a thought there. How do you, especially being a creative, I suspect you have, I'm thinking of weddings, for example, you probably have a lot of opportunity to pivot. Have you found good ways to kind of go with the flow and keep the customer service high?
Yeah. I always put them first, and I'm trying to accommodate each client because each client is very different. So early on in the meeting stage, we kind of are planning their session, and I try to get a feel for who they are, what they're all about. And I work that into the photos. And that helps them. They appreciate that. And it makes the photos better. And they remember my service because it was very personalized to them. I don't have an equation. I am a no cookie cutter photographer. I don't believe in cookie cutter equations. So maybe for sales campaigns and behind the scenes stuff. Yeah. But when it comes to being creative, for me, every session is a little different. And my clients never forget that. And when they leave reviews, it always comes up naturally that I listened to them, that I did what they wanted, that I found new ideas I never thought of that end up lining up with what they wanted. They just didn't know it yet.
Yeah.
So that helps set me apart too.
What about when you're actually on site for a wedding and, you know, things start to go wrong or go haywire? I've been around a lot of weddings. Don't necessarily need to go into all that. But my family's around a lot of weddings, and usually the photographer, if they don't have a wedding coordinator that they've hired, you kind of end up being that guy, right? It's between you, the pastor, and the DJ.
Yeah.
Are the three people that kind of run the day. How do you get everybody on the same page? You know, the other folks there that, you know, the DJs and the other vendors that are on site, you know, providing food. How do you deal with those stressful situations?
When a bride has a coordinator, that alleviates a lot of those scary situations. When they don't, it's interesting. You can tell things are thrown together and they didn't think it all the way through. So I have kind of become an in disguise wedding coordinator because I know so much about weddings. I've been doing weddings for 18 years and I started, my first wedding was, wow, when I was still in high school, which is crazy. I don't know what they were thinking. Hiring me. It was actually a graduate friend of mine. She was 1 year ahead of me. But
well, they were thinking, hey, there's a guy that's got a camera and he's not going to charge us an arm and a leg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. but how do I alleviate like stressful situations? Communication is really key. I like to ask my brides, who are your vendors up ahead of time? And especially the photographer, that's really who I care the most about. If I'm video, I'll contact the photographer. If I'm photographer and they hire a video, I'm definitely going to contact that video person and get on the same page. So we have realistic expectations and, you know, we have some plan to how we're going to work together. But timeline is also really big, having a detailed timeline for the day of. And when it comes to photo sessions, like a family shoot or a creative shoot, sometimes I'll even sketch out poses ahead of time. So I know, mm-hmm, what's going to be, they'll know as well that I can show them like, here, we're doing pose number three on this little sketched, you know, figure drawing, mm-hmm, I did. Mm-hmm. And that helps so much. Planning is really key for success in many ways.
I'm sure you've had this experience where you showed up to a venue or especially church and the church says, oh, we don't allow, you know, cameras that make noise, or we don't allow you to move during the ceremony, or
we don't allow electronic cameras because they're not holy. Yeah, that that's happened a lot. Ironically, a Methodist church had the most rules out of all the churches I've shot
really
at. And they wouldn't allow me to be on the ground floor during the ceremony. They had a choir loft 200 feet in the back,
and wow.
I've been a pastor. I'm pretty decent with my theology. So I just said, why is that? She said, well, this is a sacred moment. Like, okay. Me and my sinful camera can't be down here during the sacred moment. All right, whatever. I'll rent a zoom lens and charge the bride for that. So there is some constrictions with church venues mostly. That's really the only situations I've been in.
How do you communicate? And I know you're a good communicator because I've experienced it. But how do you communicate with your bride in that situation? It's her day. You get to the venue, all of a sudden they pull out some rules that maybe they didn't disclose previously, or, you know, what have you found is the best way to communicate that with your bride? Is send a letter, send a pigeon face to face?
Are we talking about what's your demeanor? Are we talking about before the wedding or at the wedding when surprises happen?
Let's talk about both.
Oh man. Beforehand is where you try to nip it in the bud, as the saying accurately says. And that's the guy comes back to communication, being really clear, like, hey, this is what I'm delivering. I'm not delivering this and this. I'm not going to retouch every single portrait of you and remove your tattoos you shouldn't have gotten 10 years ago. Like, you got to be detailed. And the contract comes into play there. The contract says what I'm doing and what I'm not doing. And there's a few clauses in there in my contract that says there's extra fees involved if you want extensive retouching, or if you want re-edits, or if you, you know, want to add an extra hour, this is how much it is. And
you get one of the most stressful days and supposed to be most joyous days of the bride and groom's life. How have you found that, like, you de-escalate the situation, or it's body language, tone, words? Like, what's kind of your secret sauce?
Yeah, definitely being calm and collected. If you show that you don't know the solution yet, in parentheses, then they're going to see that and they're going to freak out more. And they're going to regret hiring you because you don't know what to do. So I think it's just being calm and creative in a sense, because I have to find creative solutions to things. Like, if the wedding's running late, you know, that's the easiest problem. You just wait around and you can't do anything. But I've had situations where lighting is terrible. For some reason, a bride planned her ceremony after sunset outside. I don't know why we told her not to, and she did it anyway. So just problem solving, being calm, and if something is just physically and scientifically and creatively is not possible, just telling your client in the simplest way possible that, hey, I'm not able to do this because X, Y, Z, but let's try this, or we can do this instead.
Great. And you know, as I said a moment ago, you get great reviews, but yet you've got these contracts that are very clear, you know, and this is what I will do and what I won't do. How do you honor the contract, but yet kind of hold your people to the contract, but yet get such great reviews and they love you when it's all over?
Yeah. Well, the contract has never really been an issue, I think, because it's simple. My contract's only like 2.5 pages, so I think it's pretty short. So things are very simple. And when they read that, I think most people understand it pretty well. And then they get the idea like, okay, these are the rules. Like, Daniel Grove can use the photos for this. I can use them for that. I can't do this. I can't do that. You know, if they don't like those, then they don't hire me. But I haven't really encountered that. I think there's a level of trust when someone finds a great photographer and they love their work. They trust them. And they don't, you know, if they don't, then they're just not the client for me.
How do you handle feedback and criticism? Right? We all deal with that. You probably get more than your fair share of that sometimes.
Yeah.
How do you process that?
Yeah, criticism is a part of growing, especially in the photography world. We call it CC, constructive criticism. And it's funny, there's always some guy on a Facebook group that will give unsolicited or undesired CC on every photo he sees. And this is too bad, this is dark, whatever. And it's like, no one asks for that. But it's good to ask for it. You should ask for CC of your work. And that's helped me grow. How do I process that? You know, I have to accept their criticism and try to see where they're coming from. Because I've gotten criticism that was not constructive, that when I thought it through, I actually didn't agree with it. Because people can offer bad advice. Not all advice is good advice. And sifting through that and gleaning what you can out of it is a very valuable trait that takes a few offenses to learn. It's a nightmare when new photographers jump on the scene. They're like, look at my cool new photo. And everyone just blasts it to pieces. I feel so bad for them. That's not right. People shouldn't be doing that. That's not constructive. That's destructive criticism. Bless their heart. But that alone will make people want to quit if they don't have tough skin. So you do have to have tough skin, but you also have to have some sense of, hey, I think I can see what this person is seeing, because art is so subjective, right? Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And so everyone sees stuff totally differently. And, you know, I've looked at photos that I totally misinterpreted, and I thought it was funny. And I like laughed about a photo, and he's like, what are you laughing about? I was like, I thought this was like satire. I thought this was supposed to be a funny photo, and it wasn't.
Oh no.
I felt awful. And then we went back and forth. It got a little heated on his end. And I think I de-escalated him by just calmly explaining my thought process of how I was interpreting it as a comical thing. And he didn't attend that. I missed it.
I learned. I made a big mistake last year. I was where I office has a lot of artwork in the hallways, and a lot of local artists have contributed. And one of our first artists that came out, thankfully they're still around, and we've got I believe we've got a good relationship. I hope they feel the same. But they were showing. We were standing in the hallway, and I was meeting them for the first time, and the art curator was saying, yeah, they have these other pieces that they're going to bring in. Show them that one piece and that you're so proud of. Well, there was several pieces that were super cool, and showing me on the phone, and flips to this one piece and, you know, turns it around. And I was like, oh, wow. How old is this lady? Because and she gets this just really upset look expression on her on her face and says, "That's my 8-year-old granddaughter." It's like, oh, what? I honestly thought that was an 80-year-old lady. that I'm looking at this portrait of, you know, and it was her 8-year
old. Oh my gosh, what a trip.
Wow. Okay. So I'm a lot more careful now as I walk the hallways.
Foot in mouth. Insert foot into mouth.
Like, what are you trying to, like you know, what are you trying to express in this piece of art here? Help me understand where you were.
Art is weird like that.
Were creating it.
Art is weird like that, but also artists are weird. I think I'm not weird in the bad. I'm not weird in the normal way that a lot of artists are just strange people. And that makes it hard to understand them sometimes. And something they could be totally passionate about and all behind, you just don't get it. And that's okay. That's the nature of art.
Yeah, you gotta enjoy it. Speaking of art, where do you get your creativity and your innovation? You are quite innovative compared to most photographers. You do a lot of what you do in the digital space, you know, post photography. And I guess just pause for a moment. There may be a lot of folks on the listening in, and I would say the majority don't actually know what it is you do. Describe kind of some of the more fun stuff you do.
Sure. So I like to term my specialty, I like to call it creative portraiture. It's like as vague as I can make it, because within that, there's a lot of things. There's cosplay, which is costume play. So that short's for. So a cosplay photo shoot would be me photographing someone dressed up as a specific movie, anime, superhero character, book character, whatever that is. They have usually an elaborate, well-made costume with props and makeup and hair, wigs, all the stuff to transform them into this character that they love. So that would be cosplay. And I do a lot of that at Comic-Cons and throughout the year. But other stuff within that creative portrait world would include a themed photo shoot, which I do plenty with you guys. We've done a Renaissance themed shoot. You know, y'all weren't any particular character in history or fiction. It was just Renaissance themed. I think y'all picked like a 200-year span of fashion and stuck to that as best you could. Y'all did great. Y'all looked fabulous. We did Wild West. That's another fun theme to explore. We did Star Wars. I was a little more specific.
That's what started it all.
That was the first one, 2015, when
then there Force was kind Awakens of the Casablanca kind of
noir
theme.
Yeah, that was fun. So themes are fun in a different way because they're not specific. You can explore. You can make up your own story. You can make up your own setting and character and look. You don't have to, you know, look at this magazine or comic book or movie like, oh, they had this color, you know, top and it looks like this. It doesn't matter what you wear as long as you're within some theme or style. You know, this hippie. 70s could be a theme, an 80s photo shoot. I've done those. So themes are fun because they're a little more open-ended or less strict, and there's more room for creativity. And I like those. I like doing themed shoots because they're different. You know, you don't do them all the time. Well, I'm doing them more often than most because that's my specialty. But in some of these photos, I get the pleasure of using special effects to enhance the photo to a level that it didn't have before. So, for example, I did a photo of you guys in your Western shoot, a group photo of y'all look like y'all are walking towards the camera, very much like a movie poster. And y'all had your guns in hand, just awesome Western outfits. And y'all were in a parking lot during the original photo, but I wanted y'all to be in the Wild West. So I found some really great stock photos of Colorado, the Rocky Mountain Range. And then I found some ground photos of like a dusty country road and some other elements. I think I added a bunch of dust and, you know, flying in the air. So I put y'all into a new world that y'all did not exist in and that is impossible to find. You can't compare. Those two photos are from different places. So it doesn't exist anywhere in the real world together. Yeah. And that's really fun because I can take my clients to other worlds. And in fantasy, I can create sets and backgrounds that either we can't afford or that could never, ever be made. Which is when I'm doing more sci-fi and fantasy, wild fantasy stuff, that there literally isn't that in the real world to go shoot at. No matter what your budget is, we couldn't travel and find this, you know, whatever the background is. So being able to make backgrounds from scratch is like my superpower, for lack of better terms. I mentioned it earlier, but I do 3D design. And so that hobby, just nerdy hobby, plays into my photography in some really cool ways where I can make full 3D sets and backgrounds, just like a set designer would make a movie set or a TV set. I can make that in 3D and usually from scratch or using some pre-made objects and textures, which saves time. And so I can make custom stuff. You know, I have someone come to me like, hey, there's this character. And I look at, you know, the example images online from the anime or whatever. And it's like wild backgrounds that don't exist. I'm like, I got this. I can build that. And yeah. I will put you in that world. And that's what sets my work apart. I like to say that I don't take pictures of people in costumes. I take pictures of people as that character in that world that they would have been in if they were real. And and sometimes that's just a real location. I do have real locations. I don't do fake backgrounds in all my photos. Actually, a few of them I do. But majority of my photos have real locations, and I try to match those to whatever the character or world is. And we've done a pretty good job with you guys with that. And with my cosplay customers, when they present who they want to be, I'll start brainstorming like, okay, this character is a fantasy show. So I've got like 5 or 6 forested areas. I've got like 1 or 2 with a creek, you know, some with some really grassy plains, like which one fits best, we'll go with that. And so I try to use locations that are real because those of course are the best. I don't have to spend 5 hours
making it. Like you've done with, like you've done with us. Like you mentioned that Western where you took part of the Colorado Rockies and the dusty road and took us out of the parking lot and put us in the United States in a place that doesn't exist. Yeah. And I have shown that picture to people of all walks of life, of all ages, of all experiences, and not one yet has figured out that that's not a real photo.
Yes. High praise. Yeah. Only a few of my photographer friends, I think, I can tell at first glance, like, hey, this is a good composite. Like, composite is a composed photo, right? Multiple fake layers together. But yeah, it's a pretty good one. It sells the reality illusion pretty well, I think. And that's always my goal, of course.
Well, and then the on-site shoots that we've done, the one Western shoot, you found us a place in the area
that was so cool.
You know, had some kind of realistic looking, you know, saloon, old wood kind of stuff in the background.
Yeah.
Even the Renaissance one, you found that a place that easy. We were able to cheat a little bit using real world, but then with you work your magic and suddenly we're in another place.
I had to erase a few power lines and erase a few power boxes. But after that, you're in a little Western, you're a little country village.
Change out in the Renaissance one, change out some metal roofs for thatch roofs.
Oh, yeah. I forgot I did that.
What's crazy about that one was Nathan and I, my son, we were actually in Costco when you sent his picture through and said, hey, you know, I'm almost done. What do you think? And I was like, looks great, but it's got this metal roof next to you, which probably didn't exist at the time.
Yeah.
Oops. And then there was like a water tank kind of in the distance behind him. Mm-hmm. And I said, if he could get rid of those two, this would be the perfect picture. Yeah. And we hadn't even walked out the door and you've already sent it back with a thatched roof and the water tanks disappeared. I'm like,
yes,
that was impressive. You know, that was, I think like the second or third year we were with you. So, but yeah, the magic that you work, cause you put in, you know, I didn't realize you've been shooting weddings 18 years. How long have you been shooting cosplay?
Less. So I started that around 2014, I think, or 13, maybe. It was actually really thanks to Nate. Nate and I he had this crazy idea. Let's go to a Comic-Con. I was like, I've never been. I don't know what it's like there. I'll bring my camera. Maybe I'll get something cool. I don't know. Little did I know, I found this whole new genre that became my thing.
Yeah, and actually, it's probably what you're known for, right?
Yeah, it is.
Anybody that knows you is.
I have to, when it's appropriate, I have to insert that I do other things too. I wrote one of my friends, this kind of hurt my feelings almost, many years ago. I wrote one of my high school friends, you know, we were way out of high school still. And I was like, hey, if you ever want to do a branding shoot, because she's like this boss babe, you know, doing businesses. I was like, if you ever want to do a branding shoot, let me know. She's like, yeah, if I ever want to do something with lightsabers, I'll let you know. I was like, I have been doing other stuff for years. Like, surely you've seen, I don't just do lightsabers. Whatever. So, yeah.
That's great. But you build great lightsabers in your 3D software.
They're yes.
Super, super cool.
I have to brag about this one. And I'm going to give a shout out to the business. Crimson Dawn Sabers. They're actually here in Texas. They're in Montgomery, Texas. Eugene is the owner. He's an awesome guy. I had him on Nate and I's podcast many years ago. And he makes custom and replica lightsabers, really good quality. These are like combat, RGB, sound, motion, everything. And we connected because he saw some of my 3D designs of lightsaber hilts that I just done for fun because I love lightsabers. And so I ended up designing one for him, and it's actually in production. Like, you can buy the lightsaber that I made from scratch in 3D on his website. It's called the Invictus Saber, and it's beautiful. I'm pretty proud of it because it is really cool. But yeah, I've always loved lightsabers for various reasons, and now I have one. I actually have it in my – I should have got it out. It's in my closet over there.
Are you able to say any royalties attached to that one? Or
he paid me for the design, but no long-term royalties yet. Maybe in the future since – I think that one sells pretty good. He's bragged about it online and at cons. Good. So maybe that'll open up more doors in the future for something different.
Yeah, maybe Hollywood will be calling you up. Going, yeah, hey, right. We need some new sabers.
Dream job.
Disney's like, can you design the Mandalorians, the new saber for his show?
Absolutely.
So yeah, that'd be crazy. So any places you go to get creativity or innovation? I mean, like, just dive deeper in your mind, or
yeah,
you find stuff in the real world.
I probably sound really conceited at this when I say this, but my imagination inspires me the most out of all things. Like, I don't go looking on Instagram for ideas and I go and do them. I just start to like look back what I've done in the past and I say, how can I one up myself and find new things that I have thought of in my imagination that I haven't done yet? And I try to do those. So instead of being my own worst critic, I'm kind of like my own best inspiration a little bit. But my imagination is very active. I'm sure you see my dream posts. I like to post on about my dreams on Facebook. So, you know, my mind is always, my gears are always turning with crazy ideas and stories. And it just goes back to my childhood, I guess, being an artistic family and always watching sci-fi fantasy movies mostly. It helps a lot. So.
How do you wrestle with, I've met some creatives that kind of get lost in the art and the world of creativity and lose touch with reality, almost to the point where it's a stereotypical, oh, well, they're an artist, you know, how do you, you're dad of five, you got a household to run and care for, you've got several gigs going all at the same time. How do you engage kind of those responsibilities, but yet still maintain the creative?
Yeah, well, when you have to work your butt off just to pay your bills every month, it kind of keeps you grounded. If I made more money, maybe I'd be more at risk for that. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm thinking of something different than what you're asking. But I'm not really sure. Beyond that.
I've met some people that say, well, I'm creative, you know, don't hold me to a deadline. I'm creative. Don't hold me to, certain output. And you certainly, break all of those paradigms. You turn things around, you turn them around.
Yeah. Well,
and faster than most of your competitors, you know, it's a business.
Yeah, that's okay. That's what I was just thinking. It was the business side balances my artistic side. And this is something that I'm very passionate about, because now that I have been mentored by, Jim and some others, I mentor other photographers. And one thing that I'm really big about, I wanted to open their eyes early on about this fact, is that artists are generally terrible business people because they're great artists. And the better you are as an artist, almost the worse you are as a business owner and salesman or moneymaker with your own art. There's a lot of psychology going on there, but I'm not like this incredible business person, but I've learned things along the way, and that helps me a lot stick to being professional, being efficient and quick. I can tell when things are kind of taking too long and I need to cut that short, cause it's sucking my energy and my time out of where I need to be. And I'm not meeting goals that I need to, because people are paying me money and expecting things. So that keeps me from getting too lost.
Talk to, if a creative happens to tune into this podcast, or if you reshare it and they get to this point of the episode, what are some of your thoughts or your tips on, how do they do what you've done? How do they, if they're perfectionist, or I've met artists like, I've got all these pieces that just aren't done yet. How long's that been? Some of them have been sitting around for 5 or 10 years. How do you teach? Because you are mentoring. how do you teach that to get something across the finish line? And it's beautiful, and it's I don't want to say good enough. I'm not sure. That's why I'm wrestling for a word here, but like to the bride, this is, or to my family, the work you do is amazing. Everybody that sees it, we literally have people say, I can't, when is your, what's your theme for this year? When's your Christmas card coming out? Right. and so it's created this thing where people are actually looking forward to receiving our Christmas card and disappointed when we did, you know, our kids' wedding photo as a Christmas card, because they're like, wait, what happened to the theme? You know? So, but I'm sure you could look at it and go, oh, there was this, you know, one reflection I didn't get rid of, or there's this place over in the corner that nobody on the planet had noticed but you. Mm-hmm. How do you teach that? Just let it go.
That happened on y'all's Harley Davidson photo. You remember?
Yeah. Nobody still noticed.
Yeah.
It's you and me and Nathan. We're the only three that know. Now everybody that's got the Harley thing hanging on their fridge are going to go get zoom a magnifying in. Glass. Yeah.
That's funny. Let's see. Not getting hung up in those details, it can be tricky if you're a perfectionist. I don't know if I'm a perfectionist, but I am detail oriented. So I have a few passes I'll make over my photos where I zoom in around the edges, mostly to make sure the edging, you know, if I'm erasing backgrounds, make sure it's clean. So I have a few things in my workflow that require me to pay attention to the close detail stuff. And then once I finish that part of my workflow, I move on and I do the bigger, and I zoom out, you know, literally, and do the bigger things, or the vague things, like color everything, add more contrast to everything. And I hit a certain stage where I'm like, I've been at this for about 3-4 days now. I should be done by now. And if there's more things I could do, they're not important enough. I can't keep doing this. You know, I can't. And so my mind.
How do you teach that or encourage that to the people you're mentoring?
Yeah. It's just to keep your big picture in mind. Is that, hey, you don't just have this one photo to deliver. You know, if they're doing detailed edits, you've got a whole session. And you've already been paid for that, and you've already spent that money. So you got to move on with your life and get the next job. Set goals and set timelines and give that client an expectation. Hey, it's going to be 2 more weeks for everything to be done, or it's going to be 2 more months before everything's done, so that they're not grilling you and you don't have that weird pressure in the back of your head. So having an efficient workflow is really important. Sticking to it and not letting yourself waste your life away doing things that no one's going to notice and things that will not make you more money than you've already made.
Yeah, that's a good point. How often do you have, it seems like a lot of this is you, like your own self-control, your own management. Does your wife speak into your life and say, hey, buddy, you've been locked up in there too many hours? Or how do you kind of find that work-life balance? As I almost hate to say work-life balance, you got 5 kids, you got several gigs going on, but how do you keep your priorities, your kids feeling loved, your wife feeling loved, your customers feeling loved? How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah. Is setting kind of work hours is one way to do it. One of the biggest things you can do. So I used to, anytime, let's say after my work hours should have been done, you know, after 4 or 5 p.m. and the kids are home from school, dinner was not made yet. There's kind of that in between, you know, hour or two of early evening. I used to get on the computer. If my kids are occupied and my wife was occupied, I would go back to my computer and start editing. And I did that for a year or two or three. And then I think my wife has brought it up a few times. And I started thinking, I was like, you're right. This is not healthy. Like, I'm working too much. And I am taking away time with my kids that I'll never get back. So I realized I was working during family hours and that wasn't okay. So I stopped doing that. And now currently what I kind of have to do to keep things rolling as of right now is I work during the day, which kids go to school. My oldest 3 are in school. And so I'm working usually about 9 till like 12. Then there's like lunch and nap time. So that's a little bit of, you know, in indirect time with my wife and kids, because I'm putting them down, I'm having lunch with them. And then I work a little bit more from about like 1 to 2 o'clock. And then school pickup is after that. So there's that. And then I work at night again. And I try to
after
have,
they're all to bed.
Yeah. After they go down, I do about an hour or two of editing and then an hour with my wife before we go to bed. We watch something, we talk about the next day plan, whatever. So, and that's a self-control thing. That's definitely a priority. Or like, I could easily just edit my life away because I enjoy mm-hmm. it. Not that mm-hmm. I don't enjoy being my wife or my kids, but psychologically and being, you know, the man of the house, whatever, you got to bring home the bacon. I'm like, I got to keep working to keep the money flowing. If I slow down, it's going to slow down twice as fast and I'll be all dried up before I know it. But that's fear. And mm-hmm. that's not faith. And it's not believing that God will provide for me. It's also not believing that what I've done already is enough, that I've haven't worked enough. You know, I have, I've been working my butt off solid for like years. Mm-hmm. That's kind of it, is hours, priorities, believing in, you know, if you're a person of faith, you know, we have that faith we can rely on that God's going to provide for us. Mm-hmm. Especially when we're doing our part, you know, just sitting around being a lazy butt. I don't know if God's going to provide for you very much because you're not doing your part.
Yeah, no, there's that New Testament scripture, at work or you don't eat.
Yeah. Yeah. And faith without works, which means we believe and we do. That's about spiritual things, but also about everyday, you know, mundane human things too. So you got to believe that your work that you've been put in is valuable. And also when you are in the midst of the working time, before you have to look back and say, I hope we worked enough earlier, while you are working during that day, you have to make sure it's efficient and not being distracted mm-hmm. or wasting time. Because that's like good. I could easily be, you know, edit, Facebook, 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 edit, Facebook, Facebook, Facebook. And my hours of work is really just halved or less because distractions. And so that's something I struggle mm-hmm. with right now is distractions. So I'm trying to make my work hours more solid work. And so that when I look back, I don't worry that I didn't work enough today. I was like, oh, I definitely got a lot done today. So I'm fine. I can take the night off and not edit at all at night because I know I got deals booked. I got stuff finished. And now I can just have the whole night for my wife.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. And I'm getting closer to that more often.
Yeah. Two more places I want to go. One is to the creative that says, well, I can't just turn it on and turn it off. When I'm in the flow, I have to stay in the flow and work all night. And, you know, I can't have a real job because, you know, it gets in the way of my flow. And, you know, obviously you do amazing work. Everybody that sees your work loves it.
Thank you.
But yet you're finding, it sounds like you can turn it on and off. Are you the exception or is that just an excuse or what are your thoughts?
I'm not sure yet. I write a lot of lists, so that helps me. I can stop in the creative flow because I made a list of things I'm going to do next or ideas I've had in the middle of not being creative. I'll have ideas because the creativity is always there in the background and something will pop up and I'll have an idea for an awesome YouTube video or a funny reel that I want to make. And while I'm grocery shopping or something in middle of family time, so I'll write it on my list. I use OneNote. I was an Evernote junkie for years until Evernote sold out and got all about the money and started throttling everything. So I jumped ship and changed to OneNote. So now I have a ridiculous amount of notes and inspiration, text files and lists, that I store all of my creative stuff so that it's never lost. Cause I am an absent-minded professor. Like as smart as I like to think I am, I'm also super dumb a lot of the time. I just mess things up really good by overthinking and triple, quadruple, pentuple guessing myself. So writing things down and lists helps me a lot so I don't forget detailed stuff and don't let things slip through the cracks. I have a list of leads that have contacted me in the week. I have a list of upcoming YouTube videos and even scripts that I'll write down, bullet points, anything. It's all there. It helps me a lot.
That's very practical. Thank you for that. And then just before I let you go, spend time with your family. Thank you for giving up some of that valuable time for this.
Totally
spend
worth it.
Time with me. But AI, give me a two minute thoughts on where's AI going for the creative? Are you embracing it? Are you against it? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, man, I'm right in the middle. Like, I think it's really cool and intriguing and inspiring. I've been meaning to do some YouTube tutorials where I make a 3D scene based off of an AI render that I, you know, a prompt that you can type in a few seconds, mostly for educational purposes. When I find these accounts that are blowing up because they're only posting AI prompts that they made in 10 seconds or a minute, I'm like, you're not an artist. The stuff you post is cool. Like, I love AI art. Some AI sci-fi art is incredible. Very interesting and unique. But where is that all coming from? It's coming from stolen artwork from other humans. Most of them without consent, you know, without royalties or thanks or attribution. So it's like, it's just profiting off of human art that's been there for years, hundreds of years, and it looks cool and awesome and new, and really it's just kind of rehashing what we've already done. So to me it's not true artificial intelligence. I'm a sci-fi nerd, so I have a few thoughts about artificial intelligence that go beyond this discussion. In neural, you know, it's network, it's machine learning. It's just a really clever algorithms that based off of what we've trained it to do. So yeah, I've used text AI stuff a few times to like come up with an ad text just to see how well it turned out, and have some fun with that. The AI generative fill in Photoshop is really cool. Basically, you can select an area and you can generate extra background that didn't exist. You can create objects that weren't there. I brought my kids, when I finally got that update on Photoshop, I was like, hey kids, come here. So I had a picture of a couple with a motorcycle. It was like an engagement shoot. And I said, all right, you tell me something to add to this photo. And they're like, what? I go, just tell me something you want to see in the photo added. And they're like, a cat. So I selected an area and said, add a cat. And boom, within like a few seconds, a pretty realistic looking with accurate lighting and coloring cat was in the photo. And then you, a dragon. I was like, okay, in the sky, a dragon. And it was so fun. The kids loved it. So that kind of stuff is fun for kicks and giggles. It comes in practical. I recently had a shoot with gymnast photo shoots with like 80 kids, and my backdrop was not big enough. It was not wide enough for what we were doing on the balance beam. And so I had to use AI generative fill on about 500 pictures to fill in the gaps where the background ended. And it worked like 90% of the time. And that was incredible. Yeah. So not going to totally diss on it, because it's awesome for those kind of filler jobs you have to do sometimes that manually.
Take our original Star Wars photo in the field and add some TIE fighters off in the distance?
Oh yeah, totally. It would be super easy for that to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That'd be kind of fun. Do a tutorial on that.
Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. Yeah. And, you know,
maybe a couple of walkers, you know, coming toward us, you know, so.
Now, even if I did that, though, then I'd start zooming in and noticing the little artifacts that really trigger me. I'm like, oh, that perspective is, what was it doing? You know, it's not perfect. It probably will be in a few years. It will be indistinguishable from reality, I think, in at least 5 years, maximum.
Does that excite you, or does that kind of piss you off in some ways?
Yeah, both, because I want to use it to make my job easier, but then everyone else is going to use it to do what Daniel Grove did 5 years ago, you know, in a fraction of the time. So I don't know. I'm like that with a lot of things. I don't make up my mind because I see both sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, though, is you seem like the kind of guy will tend to embrace it and push the envelope, which is always going to keep you in the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, innovate with it. You got to change with times. You know, when the digital camera came out in the late 90s, I'm sure people dissed on that. Like, oh, that'll never take on, or that's going to steal all our jobs. Well, you know, 20 years later, they're digital. And now I'm sure AI cameras are coming soon, too, that'll do all kinds of stuff for you. And that's going to be a big upheaval. Like, oh, you know, you're not a real photographer. Use one of the AI cameras. You know, I have to change my settings myself. And that's how technology goes, right?
Well, that's like artists that used to give Ansel Adams a hard time because photography wasn't real art.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had to paint my landscapes. You know, it took me 5 weeks. You just pushed a button.
Yeah. Until you figure out all the math and all the chemicals and the hours he slaved over making that one print.
Art is always evolving. So, you just got to flow with it and use it as a tool for communication. That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, you have you've blessed my family with your art wizardry and your mastery of all things photography and photo and just you're a fun guy to be around.
Thanks. You too.
And so we love having you be part of our hopefully annual tradition for years to come. So
yeah.
We'll be in touch soon about what our thoughts are for this year's card. Ooh. For those of you listening and watching, sorry, you have to wait till December.
Yeah. So, non-disclosure agreement. Yeah. NDA.
Thank you so much for hanging out with me for a little bit, and we'll be in touch.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Have a good evening.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for joining us for this episode of A Leader's Journey podcast. If you enjoyed it, give us a thumbs up and remember to subscribe to our channel.